Hello again, and welcome to Global Exchange, part of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute's podcast network. I'm your host and vice president of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute, Colin Robertson. On this episode, we look at what last week's defeat for a two-year term on the UN Security Council means for Canada. When the vote came in, it was Norway 130, Ireland 128, the two-thirds threshold for victory, and Canada 108. Joining me are Ian Brody, who teaches at the University of Calgary, but is currently on leave to work at the Office of Leader of the Opposition. He served as Policy Director and then Chief of Staff to Prime Minister Harper. Peter Ginalo, Vice Chair of Hill Knowlton, who previously served as Canada's Consul General in Milan and is Communications Director to Prime Minister Chrétien. Meredith Lilly, who holds the Reisman Chair for Trade Policy at Carleton University, and who previously served as Foreign Policy Advisor by Mr. Harper. Jeffrey Simpson was for several decades National Affairs Course columnist for the Globe and Mail. Today, he and Meredith serve on the CJAI Advisory Council, while Peter and Ian are CJAI Fellows. Welcome, Ian, Peter, Meredith, and Jeff. For listeners, it was the second time in a decade that Canada was unsuccessful in seeking a temporary seat on the Security Council. In 2010, we lost to Germany and then withdrew after it became clear in the second ballot that Portugal would win. This time we lost on the first ballot, with both Norway and Ireland getting the necessary two-thirds majority from the 194 members of the United Nations who voted. If the decision to run in 2010 had been made by a Liberal government and then assumed somewhat reluctantly by the Harper Conservatives, this run was a personal decision of the then new Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. It was another example of his victory night proclamation that, quote, Canada is back. We were latecomers to the race. The Irish and the Norwegians had started their campaign years earlier, and this undoubtedly gave them an advantage in the early vote swapping amongst nations. The Canadian platform is also similar to that of Ireland and Norway, with its focus on multiculturalism, climate mitigation, economic development, gender equality, and peace operations. Since the onset of the pandemic, Mr. Trudeau has also been active in arguing for a multilateral response to COVID, economic relief, and future vaccines that must work for all nations, especially those in the developing world. In his statement after the loss, Mr. Trudeau observed, quote, "We listened and learned from other countries, which opened new doors for cooperation to address global challenges, and we created new partnerships that increased Canada's place in the world. This important engagement has contributed to our broader efforts to tackle the most important challenges of our time." So let's begin. What does this loss mean for Mr. Trudeau, the government, and for Canada and the world? And Meredith, why don't I start with you?
Thanks for having me, Colin. I'll jump right in. So I think for Mr. Trudeau, I hope that it would chasten him a little bit. It should chasten him, but I'll be honest, I don't know that it will. I think that this may kind of flow off quite easily. I think he's going to look to change the channel, and that's worked for him in the past, so I don't know why it wouldn't work this time. But it is certainly a defeat. It's embarrassing, and it will make things a little bit uncomfortable on the world stage for him for a little while. For the government, similarly, I would like to see less flash on the world stage. I really would like to see a lot more pragmatic, very head-down hard work on a handful of files, rather than what we've seen for the last few years, which is a lot of handshakes and smiles all over the planet. One thing that is important that many aren't aware of is that this is not yet in the rearview mirror as far as resources go. So we did get 108 votes, and that means that there are 108 favors that Canada now owes, at least. And very few have talked about this yet. But I know from personal experience from the 2010 bid that in 2015, we were still dealing with IOUs at the UN. And so I think Canadians should ask, what did we trade to get these 108 votes? And how long is that going to, what is it going to cost us? And for how long will that happen? And then finally, I think kind of the Canada and the world piece, the bigger picture piece. Sure, I think it's difficult for Canadians, perhaps, because the world doesn't see us in the same shiny light that we've been looking at ourselves. But I do want to say, I'm not sure that we should overstate just how terrible this is. The current UN Security Council table is populated with some countries that aren't exactly our best friends. It's not a very constructive or productive forum. And I'm not sure that it will be until Putin and Xi and Trump are out of power. And so since Canada isn't great friends with any of those leaders at the moment, and some of the new leaders coming on ahead of India and Mexico have real issues with our current prime minister, I think that it was anticipatable, could be foreseen, that other countries would perhaps be looking to a different country who might be able to have a stronger influence at that table.
Thank you. Peter, give me your take on, as I say, what does it mean for Mr. Trudeau? What does it mean for the government? And what does it mean for Canada and the world?
Well, listen, clearly it's a political embarrassment, given that he placed so many chips on this and it, it didn't come in. I think it's a political embarrassment for him. There's no question. And I think Meredith's right in terms of salience or the impact of that embarrassment. I think we should not exaggerate it. You know, Mr. Harper lost the security bid in 2010 and went on to win the next election with a majority mandate. So, I mean, with Mr. Trudeau, it's more that it's kind of the latest of a series of setbacks aren't going to help him. I think a couple of factors are important to point out. One is, this isn't like pulling out because we're going to lose to Portugal. I mean, Portugal was actually a country down on its heels last time around. This time we were up against two countries, both smaller than us, actually cut an international figure as large as we do these days in terms of their commitment to multilateralism, their commitment to peacekeeping. They've been more firm than Canada. Their commitment to foreign aid, they both have, I understand, larger foreign aid budgets than Canada does. So these are serious, despite their sizes, they're serious international citizens. They don't have the heft that we do. And I think that sent us a bit of a signal in the sense of the size of their economy or the fact that, you know, the tables that we sit at, that I know the Canadian delegation pushed in the final weeks of the campaign, the fact that we're at the G7 table, which seems to have less and less meaning, especially since we're not even going to be meeting this year. I have to ask myself whether or not our relationship with the Trump administration was a factor in this, in the sense that, and it's a hobby horse of mine, I feel that we've been too timid when confronting a growing authoritarianism south of our border, a sense that perhaps the last thing that other countries needed at the table was someone that would be seen as aligning itself pretty consistently with the U.S. under the current administration. So to what extent was our North American neighborhood, our shared border with the U.S., a problem for us this time as opposed to an asset? It used to be, I've heard former prime ministers say this, that, you know, part of our appeal in the past was that we would be invited into rooms the Americans weren't invited to, and then we would go and tell the Americans everything that happened, which was part of the appeal. Everybody knew that's what we were going to do. That was our role. Whereas now, as the U.S. isolates the fortress of America, we've been clamoring to remain part of that fortress through the NAFTA renegotiation. And has it come at the price of a more meaningful international role? You know, Canada's always succeeded, and I think there's been a bipartisan, for most of our history, bipartisan kind of support for Canada as a useful nation. That's what John Manley once referred to it in a conversation with him. When we play that role as a kind of useful country, not so much a preachy country, a megaphone country, but a country that actually wants to play a useful role and a practical role, that leads in areas particularly of governance, then we're appreciated. If to the extent that we maybe have moved away from that towards more megaphone style to diplomacy in recent years, I think that wouldn't have helped us.
No, and I just to caveat to your point about everybody knew what we were, when we came out of the room with the Americans, we would tell the Americans what the others were saying, but at the same time, we would act as an even useful conduit from what the Americans were trying to often say, because other countries would come to us and say, what did they just say? What does this really mean? They looked to us as being that kind of interlocutor valab, and I think that was a role that we played really well, and that underlines your point about the Manley observation of Canada as a useful country.
Now, you know, I think we have to admit, though, just one more point, that role, that traditional role, is difficult, if not impossible, in the Trump era.
Yeah, I think that's right. Ian, what does the loss mean, as they say, for Mr. Trudeau, the government, and for Canada and the world?
I think we should be very careful not to overreact to this. I don't think it matters much to Mr. Trudeau if he doesn't make it a big deal. I don't think the domestic political situation here is closely attentive to this. It's true, it's an embarrassment, but it's only an embarrassment because he made such a big deal of it. I think we could overstate the importance of taking our turn on the Security Council. And as I've said at CJI events before, you know, certainly you had a good discussion with Ambassador Rock about his time at the General Assembly. The General Assembly and the other institutions of the UN have become only more productive since Alan left that job. And so there's lots of work to be done there. The Security Council, for the reasons Meredith pointed out, has been underperforming for quite some time. And I don't think our presence there would have made much of a difference. I think the idea this is sort of some kind of indicator of a failure of Canadian foreign policy or a need for a foreign policy review is also overstated. The government's been in office now for 5 years. It's set its course internationally. Whether you like it or not, it is what it is. I don't think it's going to change that much. There are reasons to worry about Canada's international engagement, but they have nothing to do with the domestic side or with the UN side here. I think you know, for Canada is lonely for all the reasons you've just said with Peter DiNolo. If we're not seen as a trusted partner in Washington, it's hard to be Canada on the foreign stage, on the international stage. It's hard to play a role if we're not seen as having that pipeline to the United States, if the United States doesn't see us as a helpful country in that role. And I'm not sure that's going to change anytime soon, that we're kind of on the outstep with the United States. And as a result, in addition, we've had difficulty, obviously a series of terrible setbacks in the relationship with the world's other consequential country, China. That's a reason to rethink what we're doing here, but I don't think the UN Security Council bid itself is that important. Looking ahead, I don't think I would encourage the future government to bid for a Security Council seat unless the Western Europe group that we're part of agreed that we'd be one of the two countries that were put up for this job. I don't think getting into a competitive race, again, is a good idea. Getting in late, getting in half-assed, frankly, is just not worth it. It diverts resources and, as Meredith pointed out, diverts commitments from other important things we could do in the world. And we could use some imagination for some of the other roles that we play. You know, if we put this much effort into, as much political creativity into our role with the IMF, put this much creativity into our role with NATO, put this much creativity into some of the less formal international efforts that we're involved in, I think the impact would be much bigger.
And I think part of it is also putting in lumpy money.
Well, look, I mean, this is part of the problem with the UN Security Council bid, right, is that you have to have all of these side deals with, you know, 150 countries around the world. And that means you're spreading the limited resources of the government. And this government has had very limited international resources, a limited aid budget, limited defense budget, and not really much in the way of a bump up for the core kind of foreign affairs diplomatic capacity. You're trying to spread that across 150 countries around the world. And, you know, there's a reason to do that. There's Canada has interests all over the place. So there's good reasons to think about that. But there's also a good reason for focusing. You know, we're focused in Ukraine, where we have both diaspora interests and, I think, objective security interests. That's useful. I'm not sure I'd want to take the time and the effort and the resources that we put into Ukraine and spread them around 20 or 30 other countries in an effort to make a good showing at the UN. But you put your finger on it. The government has not invested enormously on the financial side in our international presence. And so even more important, I would say, to be careful and thoughtful about where we put those resources at play.
All right. First, Jeff, thank you for suggesting we do this. And for all listeners should know that Jeff and I had a bet that Jeff won. Jeff, his political acumen is analysis is clearly much better. I thought we had a good shot at this seat. Jeff did not. And so I owe Jeff on this one, which understands why he was perhaps our national affairs columnist for so long, because he always looked through and didn't let a sentiment perhaps influence how he saw things. Jeff, your former paper editorialized that this was the, quote, ultimate show about nothing. Fair comment. And again, I'm interested in your perspective as to what it means for Mr. Trudeau, the government, and for Canada and the world.
Colin, before I answer, you should tell the listeners how much the bet was.
Well, I thought it was a nickel, but it seems to have grown to $500.
It was a nickel.
In your remembrance.
It was a nickel.
My wife tells me she thought it was closer to a nickel.
It was a nickel. Which, no, I have thought for quite a long time that we didn't have any chance, despite all the efforts in the last 6 months or so. So three or four quick points. As Ian Brody, I think it was Ian, perhaps it was Meredith, made the point that Mr. Harper lost, his government lost at the UN, and it didn't matter much, certainly not to his supporters. I think the Canadians are a good deal more parochial than we like to think we are. And so I would be doubtful if this would damage the Liberal Party at the moment. People are preoccupied with COVID and with the economy and jobs and recovery and all those domestic issues, which are top of mind, understandably, for everyone. So the first thing is, I don't think it'll damage Mr. Trudeau very much, his government. And by the way, you know, the Conservatives, who are nominally the official opposition, although they're busy with their own affairs at the moment, can hardly turn around and criticize this crowd for having lost when they lost too. Second point, we are in a difficult group, Western European countries and others, and we're one of the small group of others. And it does make it more difficult because the Europeans tend to vote, not unanimously, but tend to vote in the large majority for the two candidates from Europe. However, let's remember that the last time the Australians and the New Zealanders ran for this Security Council seat for the others, they won. We've lost twice in a row. That might tell you something, because they're smaller countries, not G7 countries, and yet they won. We did not. Maybe they ran better campaigns. Maybe their international brand is better than ours. Third point I'd make, and this is more pejorative. One of the things that I think a lot of countries find distasteful about Canada, it reminds them of Sweden in the 1980s. Moral superiority, the foreign policy of virtue, of lecturing, of giving high-minded speeches. As they say in the West, Ian knows this, all hat, no cattle. And I think this is tiresome for a lot of countries. When Canada announced it was back, I think probably a number of countries that didn't much like the previous Conservative government said, great, here's the old Canadian government that we know and that we knew, and this will be good. But then the aid budget didn't grow. The defense budget didn't grow. The diplomatic presence of Canada didn't grow. The prime minister never went to Africa until a few months before this vote. That used to be very important. There's more than 50 votes there. It's an important continent growing. Paid almost no attention to Latin America or Mexico, except in the context of trade. Went to Asia, remember, for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and shocked the Prime Minister of Japan and others, as Malcolm Turnbull, the Prime Minister of Australia, has just said in his memoirs, with a last-minute demand for gender and for cultural exemptions and so on. People said, you're not serious. I have to say something rather controversial, which is that the gender thrust of the government has done nothing for it domestically, witness the last election results. And I think a number of countries at the UN would find it certainly not to their taste. It wouldn't play very well in the Islamic world or in macho world. It doesn't play well in Asian countries. It's something that a lot of countries would kind of cringe and say, oh, God, Canada on the Security Council for 2 years preaching and lecturing. And I think that this preachiness in Canadian foreign policy is counterproductive. I know it plays well with certain constituencies here in Canada. So the bottom line is, and the last point I'd make, I'm not sure it's the bottom line, is you can't have it two ways, either as a government or as observers. You can't get into the race and then when you lose say, oh, well, you know, it allowed us to reach out and reaffirm our relations with 100 countries and so on. No, you're in to win. You're not there to do that. There are other ways of doing that. So you can't, like the Globe and Mail, say, big deal about nothing. No, the government of Canada made it a big deal. And the government of Canada speaks for the Canadian nation overseas. And what it does is observed by other countries, by their leaders, by their diplomats. We made this an issue for ourselves and forced them to make a choice. And more of them chose countries other than Canada. That is a big deal. Last point I wanted to make is, I thought for some time that I've never seen Canada more alone in the world. We can't count on the United States as we used to, references made to that. We don't have particularly strong relations with Africa anymore. We don't have particularly strong relations in Latin America. We have problems with China. We have problems with Russia. We have problems with countries like Turkey. Yes, we have good relations with some key Western European countries. With Britain these days, Boris Johnson's all over the map and preoccupied with Brexit. I think we're quite alone in the world these days.
Alone in the world. Well, and this will be my last question for all of you, and I'll start with you, Jeff, going backwards. As the government rethinks in the wake of this defeat, what advice would you give them? And does multilateralism still matter? And should it still be the guiding policy for Canadian foreign policy? Jeff?
I don't think we have a choice because we're not big enough for it to be anything but multilateral. But we do have to observe that multilateral agencies, from the World Health Organization to the American attitude towards NATO, et cetera, are under, I would say, assault from within, and they're weakening. I hope that a new American administration will commit itself, recommit itself to some of these international organizations or rejoin them that the Trump administration has wrecked during its year. So we can look forward, I think, if Biden wins, to a re-engaged American government in a number of these institutions, which would suit Canada's purposes quite well. But there's no substitute, Colin. I'm sorry. There's no substitute for, well, you use the word money and commitment and energy. And if you don't have more in the foreign aid area, if we have great difficulty ordering a bathtub for our Navy, let alone a ship, and getting it done on time, if we're not committed to more of these multilateral organizations in a serious and sustained way as opposed to a nominal way, I'm afraid to say we're going to remain, well, as I said, rather alone.
All right. Alone. Ian, your advice to the government, and does multilateralism still matter?
Yes, multilateralism, of course, matters because there are collective action problems that countries find reason to resolve as a group rather than in bilateral relations. That hasn't changed. But the nature, the context of that multilateralism has changed. I think if the government does not wrap its head around its early missteps on the China file and its continuing missteps on important aspects of the China file, every other country on the planet is trying to wrap its head around China's newly assertive global role, regional role, its new understanding of its own national security and its national presence in the world. If we can't figure that out first, the rest of the multilateral work that we're doing doesn't really matter. It has to, the reinvigoration of multilateral institutions should have to be built around an understanding of the new Chinese role in the world and what we're going to do about that. Multilateralism for multilateralism's sake, which is, I think, what the UN Security Council bid was about in many quarters. I think other countries in the world figured out that this was more important to the Trudeau government domestically than it was to the Canadian interests internationally. Think through what the Canadian interest is regarding China's new role here. We have news every day about setbacks in this regard, and the government has not been able to get ahead of that. I can think ahead of that first. The multilateral piece will fall into place. I'm not worried about that at all.
Okay, Peter, sitting on the lake of lakeshore of Niagara?
Toronto, actually.
Toronto.
Listen, yeah, right on Lake Ontario, right at the bottom of Jarvis Street. Now, you know, the problem was put very succinctly by, I think it was actually Steve Chase in the Globe and Mail, is how do you ensure that in a world that's, you know, pretty ugly, where authoritarianism has taken the lead in countries that looked very promising only, you know, 10, 15 years ago, like China, even Russia, the U.S. How does Canada move and work in this world in a way that's consistent with our values and not trying to remake the world in an unreasonable way, not, as Jeff said, getting too preachy or hiring a horse about it, which turns people off. But how do we work in this world in a way that's consistent with Canadian values? I don't think the government's really been able to get its head around that. I think that's why we're having the issues we're having in China, with China, for example, and elsewhere. And I think it comes back to, you know, the useful country, that it's kind of not very exciting, but the notion of incrementalism in terms of foreign policy success, the notion in terms of step by step, leading by example as opposed to speech, being useful in a governance sense. We have some of the best governance in the world, in a whole range of institutions, public and private, in this country. And it's what the world's crying out for. So many countries in the world are crying out for expertise and leadership in these areas, whether it's the stuff as mundane as urban garbage pickup or tax collection, or whether it's our financial services expertise or judicial services experience and expertise. These are areas where actually Canada can make a real difference for countries and people around the world. And I think that we need to really refocus on, A, how do we maintain our values in this, you know, darker world, dealing with the world as it is, not as we want it to be, and B, what are the positive incremental measures that, that we can take that'll manifest themselves that way.
Well said, and I would just add to that list you did voting, because I think we're really good at, we used to send our chief electoral officers and people out to help other countries, and as...
Elections Canada is a great example.
Yeah.
So is the CRA, for example, another one. You know, it's probably one of the top agencies in the world in terms of effectiveness and transparency in tax collection. One of the biggest problems facing most countries in the world is remittance of taxes not stolen, countries getting adequate revenues for to deliver services to their citizens. We are leaders in these areas. They aren't very glamorous, but they are, you know.
As you said, useful.
Yeah.
It's useful. All right. Meredith, does multilateralism still matter, and any advice as the government goes forward?
Sure. So I agree with much of what's been said on multilateralism, so I would just add two brief points on that. One is, of course, multilateralism matters, but it shouldn't be an end in itself. And I think some of the criticisms of the current government have been that they just want to be at the table, and they don't even always know why themselves, let alone anyone else. So participating in tables where we can make a positive difference, and others on this interview have given lots of great examples. The second thing is that multilateralism and the UN are not synonymous. And so, you know, engaging in these smaller, more focused multilateral efforts, I think Canada can do a lot of good. On the advice piece, I'm actually going to give my advice to all those calling for a foreign policy review, because as Ian pointed out, I don't think it's going to happen. The government's going to want to change the channel. I won't be surprised if Mr. Trudeau avoids saying the words foreign policy for the rest of his mandate, at least for the next little while. And so if others really want a foreign policy review, and there have been a lot of calls by experts for that, I'm not saying there isn't a case for doing one, but I think it's completely politically tone deaf to think that this government is going to prioritize it or pay for it. If they were to do that, they would essentially be accepting responsibility for not having gotten the seat, and they'd be making a big deal out of the loss rather than trying to turn the page. And so my big advice is that if others want to see a foreign policy review happen, they really should find ways to get together with one another, organize it independently, pay for it independently, and ensure that they engage a broad range of stakeholders as well as broad political viewpoints if they actually want it to be legitimate and useful.
All right, good advice. Now one of the most popular parts of these podcasts, what are you reading these days? And I'll start with you and just go backwards. Meredith, what are you reading?
I am reading a bit of a heavy read for summertime, but it is called Not Working, Where Have All the Good Jobs Gone? By David Blanchflower. He's in the United States, and it's about the erosion of decent jobs in North America and the rise of populism associated with that.
Okay. A book for the times. Peter, what are you reading?
I'm reading what's a fascinating biography of Georges Clemenceau, in fact. It's called At the Heart of a Tiger. Of course, Clemenceau was known as the Tiger, by Gregor Dallas. And what's fascinating about it is it's a life and times in the true sense. It covers Clemenceau's era from his birth in 1841 to his death in the 1920s. So not a lot of focus on First World War, which he's best known for. What I'm finding fascinating is the extent to which the Belle Époque French politics resembles American politics today. Everything from the Panama Canal scandal to the Dreyfus Affair and how it echoes. You remember, I guess it was Mark Twain who said that history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. And I'm seeing rhymes between Belle Époque France and the contemporary United States.
Very good. Ian, what are you reading?
I've got the very large collected volume of Daniel Patrick Moynihan's letters given to me by a dear friend of mine. Moynihan, of course, went back and forth between the academic world and the political world in an earlier era in American politics, closely connected to the original group of neoconservatives and service in the Senate and overseas. I find his private reflections on life between politics and the academic world, it's a good thing nothing has changed.
Jeffrey?
You know,
Ian, what's on your bookshelf?
Well, just a point. One wonders if very many people are going to write those kind of letters anymore. You know, we're living in an email age, right, and Twitter, and how many people are going to be reflective in the way that he was, sit down and write those kind of letters? I don't know. I envy you reading them. I just finished a book, Colin, for a book club, which I highly recommend, called Black Wave by Kim Gattas, who's an outstanding journalist based in Beirut. And she basically takes two events that occurred simultaneously in Saudi Arabia and Iran, the Khomeini Revolution in Iran and the attack on Mecca. They happened at about the same time. And they radicalized considerably both of those countries. And the rivalry between the two countries goes on today. It's one of the defining characteristics of the Middle East. It has produced a radicalization on the Shia side and in parts of the Sunni world, which is, of course, spilled over into terrorism and ISIS, etc. And so it's a wonderfully explanatory book by an extremely well-informed observer, which deals with the competition between these two countries and their Islamic sect, and is a very, very fine book to help understand better an extremely complicated part of the world. It's called, as I say, A Black Wave.
A Black Wave. All right. Well, thanks for listening to this episode of The Global Exchange. We were joined today by Ian Brody, Peter DiNallo, Meredith Illy, and Jeffrey Simpson. Remember, you can find the CJAI Network on iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play. If you like the show, give us a rating. You can also find the Canadian Global Affairs Institute on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. And that's where you'll get the links to the books and pieces that all of the participants have written over time. The Global Exchange is brought to you by our team at CJAI. Thanks go out to our producer, Jay Rankin, and to Drew Phillips for providing our music. I'm Colin Robertson. Thanks for joining us today on The Global Exchange.